Welcome to the Brave Feminine Leadership Podcast, where I get to dig into delicious conversations with global leaders and we get to soak up their wisdom and perspective on life and leadership. And today I'm absolutely thrilled to have Wendy Pavey with me. Wendy, brilliant to have you join the conversation.
Thank you, Melissa. I am delighted to be here in front of your audience. It's a terrific podcast and I hope I can provide value to your audience.
Fantastic. Now, let me share with our audience, for anyone who hasn't had the pleasure of coming across you before, Wendy has turned a three-decade career in brand-based communication into a mission to elevate transformative leaders to pinnacle roles with our most significant organisations. As a brand and career strategist, she guides ambitious executives and advisors to build the story, profile, and network that attracts their dream roles. And Wendy, I've had the pleasure of seeing that firsthand as part of introducing you to one of our network groups, which has been absolutely amazing. But I would love to hear in your own words, tell the audience, who are you as a human being?
This is such an interesting question. Just last year, I did this exercise on identities because we tend to, I think, define ourselves in relation to other people. So you might tend to say, you know, a mother, a partner, a sister, a daughter. And while those things apply, this exercise challenged me to not define myself in relation to other people. So let me tell you what I came up with. I'm a writer. That is my passport occupation. I love words and language and communicating as best I possibly can. I'm a reader. I read a lot, probably too much, sacrificing sleep because they're books that I must read. I am someone who is trying to learn a language slowly, very slowly. I think I always thought of myself as not being artistic, and I was challenged on that. I think of myself as creative, but not artistic. So I have actually been doing a painting class, like painting for dummies, but because that's what fits my skill level. I love to be of service and to be a community member of many different communities and to contribute. You get so much more back though than what you give in terms of time and energy, you know, the mentoring that I do. I always feel like I'm getting so much more out of it than my mentees are. But those things sum up who I am and what's important to me. I mean, we could add a few other things. I do a weekly yoga class, but I would not call myself a yogi.
I hear you. I have to ask, what's the latest must read keeping you awake at night?
I was slow to get to it, but I've just finished reading Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow.
I've read that.
Such a beautiful book, and not at all what I don't know what I expected from it, but I think it was one of those. It was on my Christmas list, just didn't get to it. And then it was sad. It was so sad, and yet it was so beautiful and beautifully written, and the characters. Wow.
I absolutely loved it. Yeah, wholeheartedly agree. Absolutely loved it. And which language are you mastering currently?
Mastering. I'm learning French, something that I did at school, but I can only say that we must have just skated over the absolute, you know, la plume de ma tante kind of level, because now I'm learning concepts and I'm actually not that far into it. While I've been doing it for nearly 2 years, I'm only just at the beginning of level two, which is still very basic sort of, you know, sentences and concepts. But it's, as I say, I've gotten much further than I ever got in high school.
Absolutely brilliant. Can't wait for progress updates on that one. Wendy, I love how you kicked off with such a clear identity and that you managed to do all of that without really talking about what it is that you do during the day to keep you busy, what your family status is, like any of those things. And I know that so many people find it so hard to introduce themselves and to talk about themselves. That alone was brilliant for anyone listening in the audience. I mean, if you can actually just spend a few minutes trying to work out how to come up with that, that's absolutely incredible. Wendy, talk to us about, you know, your career as a brand specialist. What did that mean? What were you doing? And then let's get into the why did you transition away and to what you actually do today?
Well, if we go back to when I was at school, pretending to learn French, I was absolutely committed to being a journalist. As I said before, I love writing, and I just felt that that would be the pinnacle role for me. So I studied that at university, but I quickly realised that most journalism is not the kind of, you know, earth-shattering, groundbreaking, no. It's quite rote, and I got bored with that very quickly. So I switched to politics, and I did a double major in political science. By some miracle, I managed to get work in politics afterwards, which I look back on now with utter amazement, because I think about I had learned, you know, political theory from, you know, ancient philosophers. And why I thought that would be relevant, because what politicians want to know is how can you get me elected or re-elected? They don't care what Aristotle said or Locke's theory of property rights or whatever the heck
it was. But you've got it. You've got it if they need it.
They trust me, they didn't need it. Well, look, so you can imagine there was I working in Parliament House in Canberra for a senator, and very, very quickly realised I did not like this at all. Instead of getting out of politics, I went to work for a state minister, and that was a tough gig. It was really shattered any remaining illusions that I might have had. And, I mean, politics is about compromise, and often the compromises you have to make are kind of soul-destroying because we have this adversarial system. I remain politically engaged in the sense that I, you know, I'm deeply interested, and I think it's so important that everybody is interested and that we elevate the quality of the conversation. But yes, it's hard to be idealistic and to work in politics. So then I transitioned into public relations, I guess, thinking that was better. What was valuable about that was that, you know, I think that was the beginning of me seeing how when you communicate really well, really effectively, you can create impact. And from there, I was able to do brilliant work for iconic global consumer brands like Apple, like Gatorade, like Gillette, Nokia. I mean, the kind of thing where you have big budgets and you can make a splash, you know, brilliant, brilliant experience. And from there, again, my writing skills came to the fore, and I did a lot of corporate communications, writing annual reports and newsletters. That segued into developing brand names, work that I was very good at. And I loved the challenge of trying to communicate so much and often just one word and often just, you know, one word with one syllable as well, and making sure it could be trademarked and protected. But you can only come up with so many names before the well runs dry. And while I did some cool things like ice cream, for example, most of it was much more run of the mill, you know, like a name for a new professional services firm. And that just gets that, you know, as I say, the well runs dry. So I made a return to the UK. My parents are Brits, and I've lived on and off in the UK all my life. I wanted my son to get to know our English family. And so he was at the right age before he'd started high school. So we went over there, and I had a corporate role there, which I really enjoyed. But what I think the turning point was from moving from, you know, corporate brands and consumer brands was that organization was headed by someone who was interested in building what we would now call our personal brand.
Right.
And I could see the value of that. I could see why that would be important to investors, why that would be important for the media, for consumers, for customers, for, you know, your business partners and your suppliers. So when it was time for my son to start high school, which I thought, well, if we stay in England, he's going to have an English accent. nothing necessarily wrong with that, but it just felt like his identity would shift away from being Australian. And so we returned to Australia, where I naively thought I would begin a corporate brand consultancy. You know, Australia, I love being in Australia, but it does not compete often on the world stage in the same way that European countries do. For the company I worked for, which was in renewable energy and sustainable construction, our competitors came from Denmark, from Spain, from all, and that was just the norm, that you functioned like that. Here in Australia, we tend to compete with other Australian companies, and sometimes there can be quite a parochial view to competing against someone from Singapore or Philippines or... And that, I think, meant that perhaps corporate leaders here were not as on the forefront of personal brand as they may have been in London. So it took me some time to build that momentum and to actually, you know, be able to, you know, pay the bills by just simply focusing on personal brand. But that's been the story for the last more than a decade now. I've focused on personal brand for corporate executives and for advisors.
Have you seen a shift in that time? Because listening to you talk about the fact that perhaps Australia didn't, executives here didn't need to or didn't see the benefit of personal brand, was there a turning point in your mind? Because I certainly think we hear a lot about it now.
I think absolutely. It's the concept of personal brand, I think, was more to the, you know, in the minds of perhaps entrepreneurs and business owners and people who actually needed to sell a product or a service. I think for corporate executives, that was something that they only needed to do should they be applying for a role or, you know, looking for a new job. Now I think there's a much better understanding that, well, this is something you need to pay attention to all the time, because calamity does befall people in their careers. You are going to be much better positioned to survive some adversity if you've maintained some visibility, you know, if you've been building and nurturing your network, you know, if you can talk about your career in a way that has people understanding the outcomes that you can deliver. These are really foundational skills, and they make a tremendous difference when you've got them. You know, when we can meet in conversation and I can say, this is what I do and this is who I do it for and this is why they do it, it makes a huge impact. But most of us tend to feel constrained in making that presence felt, particularly for women. You know, we are reluctant often to be out there.
So, Wendy, let's be really clear. What is it that you do today in that space?
So I work with those executives and advisors to do those things, to know what are the right messages for them. What do they need to be able to say? You know, and what are the details of that story that they need to tell? So the components of that, it's not just an elevator pitch. That's, you know, maybe 20, 25 words that you say, but to have a conversation with someone, you need to be able to go more deeply into it. And you want to be able to adjust it to the person, to the situation, to the context, and not just have this sort of, you know, rote learned pitch that you deliver all the time, every time, really without any thought to its appropriateness. So that, developing that story, making sure that you are visible in the right places, and, you know, right places depends entirely on what your objectives are. You know, where do you want me to help you get to? We need to, that's the starting point always, is that sort of strategy that is aligned with your career objectives. You know, it's making sure that if you look at someone on LinkedIn that you think, wow, they look great, and not be scratching for what have they actually done in these roles, or what do they offer? What is that value proposition, as we often say in branding? that building and nurturing of network. We tend to think when we're looking for a job that it's about applying for jobs, but people really need to know that the vast majority of jobs are not advertised. They are filled through informal networks typically. So you're not going to be considered for any of those opportunities if you don't have that network, and that you, if you're not communicating with those people. I mean, how can they know where you're at, what you've been doing, if you don't tell them?
So let's pause on that sort of visibility aspect, because I know it's a huge one and it's where we connected as well. A lot of the senior female leaders that I get the chance to work with are deeply uncomfortable about networking. And often it has, it has a bad rap, right, in terms of what people actually understand it to be. And, you know, so quite often people actively avoid it as well. So can we just talk a little bit about that? Because I think you were able to shine a light on networking that made it much more achievable for people. And I'd love it if you could just a little snippet, because you don't want to give the whole game away, but, you know, a little snippet on what your advice is around networking and visibility.
So what the approach that I take is highly strategic, and it really is about that analysis of, you know, who do you need to be connected to? Who are the right people? You know, it's so easy to say, you know, you need to know the right people. Well, who is that? And to actually go through that process of saying, well, these individuals who you can discover on platforms like LinkedIn, or by going to your professional association or asking your existing network for introductions. But it's making sure that there's a point to it. It's meaningful. You know why you're doing it. You're not doing it just so you can, you know, accumulate more connections on LinkedIn. You know, just being connected to someone doesn't serve any purpose whatsoever. So that, you know, and if you think that that's your networking, then you'll find that if you are in a time of adversity in your career, that what you thought you had around you, you actually don't. And that is a horrible, horrible realization. Some people don't come to that realization until they've been out of their role for a period of some months, and they're thinking, oh, I thought I would just find another job so easily, and they haven't. And, you know, that can really create a negative spiral from that point of view, because you start to make up stories about, oh, well, I haven't been offered a job, therefore I'm no good at what I do. And,
yes. You
know, nobody likes me, everybody hates me. And you just, you know, you retreat further and further into that dark place. So the visibility is key because it's linked to credibility. You know, I always say that the two components of what people might call a personal brand are visibility and value. And the two, they fit together, they are interdependent, because being visible without a value message is just you out there creating noise. Being valued but with no visibility is silence. You know, people can't offer you a role if they don't know who you are and what you can do. So those two components are absolutely key. You know, being able to really quite ruthlessly look at who you need to have in your network as you progress through a campaign of activity to get a new role, for example, or to be positioned for promotion. You need to think about, well, who actually are the individuals who can help me, and how do I go about building the right kind of relationship? Which is not about, you know, being best friends. It's about just being known, making sure that if someone looks for you, they can find you, that there's something there where you're telling your story. And this doesn't have to be, oh, I was written up in the Financial Review about some great achievement. I mean, that's almost certainly not going to happen. But it's thinking through, well, what are those touch points where I would like to have a presence, that if someone was Googling, where would I like to show up? And then we'll set about creating that presence and that visibility for you.
What about those awkward events where, you know, you grab a glass of champagne or whatever it is they're offering and work out, do I sidle up to this group and sort of bust my way in? Or, you know, what about those events? Are they valuable?
I think they are valuable because it's an opportunity for you to take that give to get approach. For myself, I go into a room and I don't know anyone, and I'm not thinking about how can I get in front of a prospective client and sell myself to them. But instead I'm thinking, how can I be of service to someone else? And I will look for that person who is standing alone. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll look for some way that I can make it a nice experience for that person, to engage them in conversation with no thought of, I have to sell this thing. I think that's not a helpful energy at all. But mm-hmm. to go in there and say, this is not about me. This is about what can I do for someone else. You'll have a great conversation. That person will be so appreciative. And that's the measure of success for me. Not, oh, I met 10 new people and now yes. I'm going to connect to them on LinkedIn.
Yes.
But was there one person that I positively impacted? And along the way, I've created some visibility for myself as well.
Let me take a brief pause from listening to the podcast for a minute just to check in and see if the conversation's inspiring any new thoughts or any new reflections for you. I hear so often from people in our audience, largely successful and senior professional women, how much they are craving some inspiration into their lives. I would just love to share with you, if you're looking for some, then come and sign up for our Sunday Inspiration email series. You can find a link in the show notes at the end of the show. Now let's get back to the podcast. You know, early in these interviews, one of the people that I spoke to shared, and I can't recall off the top of my head who it is right now, but talked about the fact that when you go along to those events, and it's kind of similar to what you said, but they said, imagine that you're hosting a dinner party in your home. You know, you wouldn't allow someone to be standing on the side by themselves. You would step forward and find a way to engage them. And so it's very similar to what you're saying about go along and put yourself in a different kind of situation, so to speak, to do that. So you and I are really both focused on trying to find ways to help people move into pinnacle roles to kind of fulfill their ultimate potential. And, you know, I kicked off a conversation with you when we first met some time ago about, well, why are there not more women in these roles, particularly in those senior decision-making roles? So let's go there. What's your perspective working with a large number of senior executives? Why are there not more females in those roles?
There are several key reasons that I see. And the first was brought home to me really powerfully at an International Women's Day event, where this very senior executive was talking about the first time she joined a senior management team. Not only was she the only woman, but she realized she was the only one in a dual career relationship. So the other people at the table all had their domestic, their family responsibilities taken care of by someone else. Mm-hmm. If I think about the brain space, the extra brain space that I would have had in the early days of a previous business where I had employees and I, you know, had a small child as a single parent, I mean, I think about how much more successful, how much more productive and effective I could have been if someone else was responsible. I mean, at that time I worked school hours because what do you do?
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of factors that underpin that. But just that inequity and a corollary point there is that you can have all the family-friendly policies that you please, but if the senior management team don't take advantage of those policies, then there is a subtle but unmistakable message that if you want to be at that level, well, you won't be leaving at 3 p.m. to do the school pickup or, you know, to care for an elderly parent. Or So there's real systemic, you know, social inequity there. I don't know how we challenge that, because there's lots of components to it, but it's very real. It's very real, I think, when you get up into those busy roles. I think definitely for women particularly, we overcompensate, we overcorrect in terms of what I call that fetishizing of humility, that we have this idea. If you imagine a spectrum of activity with that sort of, you know, like nun-like humility at one end, and at the other end, that kind of like obnoxious bragging and boasting, those are the two ends of the spectrum. In the middle is a whole range of perfectly reasonable, socially acceptable activity that you can and should be doing. But in our minds, we see the boastful bragging as 90% of that activity, and it just isn't.
Mm.
But we keep hearing those messages, oh, it's important to be humble. So we think, oh, well, I better not say anything then, because I don't want people to think I'm bragging. Women are overcorrecting massively. It means that our voices aren't heard, our presence isn't seen. You know, there have been a few high-profile appointments of women to big-name companies in recent times. I don't see those women really taking up space in the way that I might have hoped that they would.
Mm.
Now, I don't want to lay blame at the feet of someone who's managing a, you know, multi-billion
enormous dollars. Yeah.
But this is a real issue, is that we're so concerned about, you know, not seeming like we're full of ourselves, that we're choosing to be silent.
Yes.
So I was saying before, you know, when you are silent, nobody sees you, nobody knows your name, and you're limiting the opportunities that you can be offered. And I think the key thing, the last key thing that I see is that, you know, those senior roles are really, really hard.
Mm.
They are so demanding. They put a toll on your relationships. They put a toll on your health. And especially as women get older and you start to come into perimenopause, it's like, who needs this? Who needs this? So women take lesser roles. They say, oh, I'm happy to be at this level, because then I don't have to be up there with all those additional demands. And especially, you know, you've got school-age children, you know, you've got your partner in a busy career. It's like, it's just too much. It's just too much. Mm-hmm. So women are taking lesser roles. And I think they're also moving at a much younger age into the portfolio career. So where you get to ideally pick and choose the work that you do in a dynamic and an exciting mix of work, it's like, well, why wouldn't you do that and have that freedom and flexibility, especially when it is possible to attract, you know, well-paying advisory and board roles and get that mix of work that you're getting the money. Maybe it's not exactly the same, but you think about the freedom that comes hand in hand with that. Well, that's super attractive.
So how do we, I mean, there's so many things there, systemic things, all sorts of things going on. And I do believe in some of those that over time we will see change in that, because I think it's also, you know, I think we talk about this patriarchal society, and I think it locks young men in as much as young females. So I think there's massive opportunity in that space. But how do we influence some of these incredibly talented women who often are, you know, a step away from the pinnacle roles in their career? How do we convince these women to stay?
Well, this might be a bit controversial, but in some ways, the more bad behavior that we see from senior men, I think sometimes that really does catalyze women to go, that's it. I've had enough. I know I can do better, and I'm now going to actively ask for the opportunity to do better.
Mm.
So, you know, when we see behaviors, or we hear stories, we see how little progress has been made and how slow it has been.
Mm.
I think that can really give that much needed boost. We can also, as women, make sure that we are not the ones who are making critical comments about someone's personal appearance, about how they might be aging, or, you know, what the state of their health and fitness might be. I think have all been exposed to unsupportive behaviors from other women. And that really hurts. That really hurts when we think that we should be able to look to others who are experiencing the same kinds of challenges. But often that's not the case, and it is sad, and I don't feel good saying that, but I think nevertheless many women would agree that that's been their experience, that that senior woman that they thought would, in Kirsten Ferguson's wonderful term, throw down the net, they don't. That they move into those same kinds of protective behaviours that we have seen so often for senior men. It's up to all of us to make sure that we push back when we see commentary about a woman's physical appearance in a setting where there's no parallel commentary made about a man's appearance, where we make allowances for somebody who might be, you know, doing the juggle, who doesn't have a partner at home to, you know, care for an elderly parent or look after children. You know, we don't know what's going on in people's lives. We tend to make assumptions. Let's make generous assumptions. Let's always make sure that it's not us, you know, with the disapproving looks or, you know, the unkind comments behind someone's back. That term, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. Well, that's absolutely true. But not if we're, this is a mixed metaphor, but not if we're pulling the plug, you know, out
at the same time.
Bath, exactly. And undermining someone. You don't have to like every woman that you work with. I've certainly been challenged in that realm myself. But to provide respect and a measure of empathy and understanding, because those changes will benefit everybody. And as you rightly said, I mean, I have a 23-year-old son, and I want this to be better for him as well.
Yeah,
I don't want him to be caught up in these old ways.
I love what you talk about with generosity there, because it made me think instantly of Brené Brown when she defines trust, and she uses the acronym BRAVING, and the G in that acronym stands for generosity. And it's so true that, you know, I think, and I wrote an article about this recently as well, you know, as female leaders, if there's an inch of us thinking, I had to do it hard, so you should too, then I think it's time for us to kind of look in the mirror, because as leaders, we get a chance to make those changes. And I've spoken to so many wonderful female leaders who know that part of the driver and part of the benefit of getting into these key decision-making roles is you can make a difference for everyone as well. So I want to ask, how do you create a personal brand that stands out? And, you know, I'm super happy to share. You made me think of this earlier when you were talking about so many people moving to portfolio careers. So I opted to do that. That was after a health scare and not go back into the executive space. Arguably, I'd been a CEO at that point. So it was like, okay, here we go, something different. Mm-hmm. And it was so fascinating to me because I joined a program to kind of go through that. I'd done the company director's course years before and things like that, but I joined a program to kind of nurture me. And the interesting thing about that was, I think the key thing that went on in that program with 10 really senior females who'd had brilliant careers was helping them with confidence to this next phase, because everybody around that table, having been an executive previously, if they'd been in a sales role, it had been selling the company and selling the company's products and services, not themselves. Hugely different thing. So how do you sell yourself?
That's beautifully expressed, Melissa. We are often so comfortable selling something that is a product. You know, we're selling our company's services and do a really good job of that. And then when it comes to selling ourselves, we just don't. We just, I think because it's uncomfortable, then we interpret that as I shouldn't do it. And we are very quick to, you know, to feel the fear and not do it at all. Interpret that in a way that is not helpful. You know, if you understand that our brain is always trying to conserve its cognitive resources, loves doing things, you know, on autopilot, just so that there's always, you know, keeping some, you know, cognitive ability in reserve in case we have to suddenly, you know, fight for our lives. But that when you understand that, you can work through it and say, well, all right, we don't need to, you know, fight off any saber-toothed tigers today. We can hive off a little bit of that to do these things and to get comfortable in the discomfort. And of course, like all those things, you know, you stretch a muscle and it hurts the next day, but then you keep stretching it and gradually you become more flexible and limber until you think, oh, I could actually bend over and touch my toes. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen instantly. And of course, if you try to do it and you can't and you go, well, that's hopeless, I'll never be able to do it, then you'll never be able to do it. Mm-hmm. But if you do it bit by bit, in terms of a standout brand, I mean, it really is knowing the right messages and showing up in the right places and being connected to the right people. But here's the thing, most people are not going to do any of that. So it is actually quite easy to stand out just by doing a small amount of those things, because most of your peers are sitting at home going, I don't want people to think that I'm boasting, so I won't put anything on LinkedIn. So you don't actually have to do very much to stand out. If you are deliberate and strategic, then you'll only need to do the minimum viable amount to get results. So if it does make you uncomfortable, you can know that, well, I'll only have to be in this place of discomfort for a short time, and that's going to be enough. And then you'll be able to achieve your goals.
You break it down into, and I've got a copy of your wonderful book here, Personal Brand 101. You actually break that down into a process. So executive cadence, I think you call that process. What's one or two things, and I would encourage people to find themselves a copy of the book, which they can. I think it's an Amazon bestseller. But I would just ask a question. If you were going to give someone two things, maybe it's different for everyone, I don't know, but two things that they could step away from that could be just the minimum, where would you start?
So you absolutely have to have an understanding of the value that you can deliver to an organization. What are they going to pay you to do? You need real clarity on that. And you want to be as specific and as measurable as you possibly can, because that's why someone is going to offer you a job. When you say, I can help your organization do this thing, you have to make sure that thing is going to be valuable to that organization, and that this is strategic, isn't it? This is about saying, I want to work for company X. What is company X trying to achieve in the market? No point going in there with your purpose-led, culture change, if they have to be focused on a cost-out program. It's not going to match up. There's no alignment. So you need to be specific about what you want to do. Find a way to frame what you do in terms of what is meaningful to the organization. So being crystal clear on value would be one thing.
Can I jump in there before you do number two? Because I think that's incredible advice. And I think there's a lot of people who are in big roles today who can't articulate that question themselves. Because I know one of the things I talk to people about most often is make sure you can see a really direct line of sight between what you do and the company strategy, how the company creates value or whatever matters to them. And so if you can do that in your role, you've got a far better chance of doing that when you're preparing to find another role. So I think that is fantastic advice, regardless of where you're at in your career. Number two,
look, I'm a brand person. Brands exist to create a reason why you would choose one thing that is fundamentally similar to other things. It helps people choose. So to have a point of difference can be game-changing. Mm-hmm. It's, again, if it can be linked back to the value that you deliver, that's really helpful. But try and find something that people get with you that they don't get with others. How are we going to determine this? Well, strategy again. You know, look at people who are in the role that you would like to be in. Look at people who already work for that company. See what they're doing. What can you bring that's different? Mm-hmm. The same if you're looking internally in your company. You know, look at the backgrounds, look at the qualifications and experience of the senior leadership team. What can you bring that's different? And don't allow yourself to go, well, I'm a lawyer, or I'm an accountant, or I'm in HR. There's nothing different about me. Well, you need to create that point of difference. And it might sound daunting, but it's actually easy and it's fun. It's something I really enjoy doing.
What's an example of something that you've been able to help someone?
All right. So I mentioned lawyer before. And so a client who had been a lawyer for a long time, had not really done any formal study since achieving a law degree nearly 3 decades prior. But when we talked about what was the kind of work that she loved doing, what was she really interested in doing, what would she be good at, she came from a family that had a rural agribusiness, and we talked about the impact of drone technology on the way that they managed the property. This just became a point of focus for her that she could learn about drone technology. And this is going back some 6 or 7 years. So it's obviously a ever-growing field, but bringing the legal lens to it. So saying, well, what are the legal implications if you're going to use drones to check your fences, for example? The way that we built expertise for her was simply going on a learning journey, having conversations with people who were developing drones, you know, talking to academics who were studying these issues, talking to other lawyers who had expertise in the rural space but didn't necessarily know anything about this topic either. It was just acquiring knowledge which was shared as she went on that learning journey. There was no, oh, I'm now an expert in this, because she clearly was not.
Mm.
But to be able to create that focus. After a time, she actually was listed on the firm's website as their expert in, actually, they don't really say drones. They say, I think that the term then was unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs. So it was, it became a thing. And then it became, oh, I'm going to speak at the World Drone Congress about the legal perspectives on this.
Brilliant.
I mean, such a simple thing, really. Just finding something that was meaningful to her because of her backstory. But as I say, it wasn't about trying to become an instant expert. That's phony. That's fake. That's what people don't like about personal branding, that they feel that, oh, this isn't genuine. You demonstrate that it's genuine by sharing what you are learning as you're acquiring that knowledge. So that's an example that was really, really successful.
Fantastic. So, Wendy, you know that a question I ask everyone in this podcast is, what does brave feminine leadership mean to you, and do you think it needs to change?
Well, what needs to change, I think, is to embrace the brave, because what I find about any time that I am brave, not only have I made a brave action, which I can then feel fantastic about, to think that I've got the capacity to do it, it actually increases your capacity to do it. I think you end up in this sort of wonderful where it fuels your ability to do something else brave, maybe something that's braver, that's bigger and braver. It's like this limitless well that you can draw upon if you'll take that first step. And then how good does it feel that you did that thing, that you reached out to that person, that you asked them for something, that you signed up for a course that you know nothing about? They're often small things, but they can just propel you to phenomenal heights, and it need only start with something tiny. I think I love that you bring those two terms together, because I really think that is missing. You know, I talked before about the lack of visibility you see from women who are in senior roles. And a lot of that, I think, is because there is that lack of bravery. I so want to see that change, that we embrace what you get from being brave. It far outweighs, like, even if you get a no, you've still got all the positives surrounding that you made the ask, that you said, can you help me with this thing? Can you introduce me to this person? Doesn't matter that you got the no, because you still made the brave act.
Wendy, thank you so, so much for joining our conversation today. I know you will have added enormous value to the audience, and it's just been a pleasure having you join our conversation.
Thank you, Melissa. Great, great questions that have caused me to think deeply, and I hope it's been valuable for your listeners.
Brilliant. Thank you, Wendy.
And that was the end of another podcast conversation. So thank you so much for listening to the episode today. I often hear from leaders who felt inspired by the conversations and are ready to put themselves first. And so I wanted to take a brief moment just to share how I've helped hundreds of women, just like you, become crystal clear on the exact steps they should be following right now to lead an intentional and sustainable life without second guessing themselves, so that they can maximize their influence and impact. I've put some details into the show notes, and there's a link there where you can find out some more about our signature Elevate and Influence program. While you're there, take the time to sign up for our Sunday Inspiration email series. Have a brilliant day.